Hi, everyone. So this is where, in a normal, successful podcast, you might hear a sponsor ad, something we've been missing at Coach Your Brains Out. So we're asking for some listener help instead. If you enjoy the show and are able to support it, we'd love to have you head over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/coachyourbrainsout. Anything you can contribute, even $1 an episode, $4 a month, would really help cover our hosting costs and John Mayer's speaking fee and help us continue doing the show. That's patreon.com/coachyourbrainsout. Thank you. We appreciate the support. Now here's today's episode.
Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
All right, we're joined by three-time All-American from UCLA, an AVP legend, an Olympian, and now a broadcaster, Kevin Wong. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, you guys.
Kevin, besides being an imposing player at 6'7", at least to John and I, you were also regarded as a savvy veteran who found little ways to control the game and gain mental edges. Would you say that's a fair description, or is it just in our heads?
You know, I think if you're not figuring that out by the time you're a veteran on tour, you're losing some of your competitive edge, right? As you start losing vertical, you better start figuring out some of the other things.
So that wasn't always a part of your game. Like early on, you weren't thinking that way.
Oh man. Well, out of UCLA, we had the swagger, but, I was just coming in full blown attack mode, you know, like there was probably a lot of Casey Patterson in my game back then.
So then what are, as you aged and as you became a veteran, what were some of the things you'd use to try to gain a mental edge over opponents?
I think you just learn along the way, right? And it's different times too. So I think that that's part of the difficulty now. It's a bit bigger challenge, but, you know, obviously momentum is one of the big, ways to, that's really important in any sport, right? So how do you speed things up when things are going well? How do you slow things down when they're not? And, you know, back, when I was playing kind of in my prime, it wasn't a 12-second clock. It was, you had some time to go wipe off your glasses. You had some time to interact with the crowd. So there were a lot of opportunities to control momentum.
So you were aware kind of when things were going your way, you were trying to play faster, trying to like step back and serve as fast as you can, things like that.
Yeah. I think that you start figuring that out. Right. You know, I coach a lot of kids these days, and I feel like too much time is spent on the little things, right? The details, your angles and your platform and all these things. And I think that what I learned from a lot of the best competitors, playing with Karch along the way, it's the big things that really matter.
So do you teach your players to start stepping into the court when they're serving like you did? conserve some distance.
That's part of it, right? Is how do you shave? How do you become more efficient? Someone called me the Prius one time, and I kind of took that as a little bit of a compliment, right? You gotta, beach volleyball is an endurance sport too, right? So how do you get every bit of benefit? And I wasn't one of those guys who could out grind other people in terms of conditioning, so I had to figure out some other ways.
Kevin, do you remember any stories where it was the mental side that got into a player's head you were playing?
Yeah, you know who I learned a lot from was Stein, and he had it at a young age. He's just, you know, I think good players know how to take care of themselves and get themselves ready to play. I think great players can do that, and they can also help their partner get better. And then I think the Hall of Famer types, at least in my book, then they can also affect the other side. And Stein was a guy who knew how to push people's buttons. I remember a final where we were getting ready to play against Ricardo and Emmanuel. They were like the best team in the world. And Stein just had this little glint in his eye before the match. And he's like, you watch this. I'm going to get Ricardo freaking out within the first 5 points. And, you know, when someone on your team like that and you're getting ready to go into to battle, and there he got that much confidence. It's infectious, right? And the next thing you know, he was chirping in Ricardo's ear, and Ricardo was starting to freak out, and he was, you know, he just kept on pressing that button, and we ran away with that one.
Is this, you think this is a, like a learned skill, like, you know, with players, would you try to develop this, or is this something like kind of part of Stein's DNA or part of, you know, certain people's DNA?
I think it's like everything, right? You know, some things might come more naturally to you, but I think that you can practice it all. And he had a natural gift, but like, you know, you get better at it. You get better at it. Whether some players you celebrate more against and some players you celebrate less against, you know, for Phil, anytime I played Phil, I didn't celebrate much at all.
Because he was blocking you all the time, or
yeah, that's what? Why I don't celebrate against him.
Dude, the crazy thing is, maybe I'm misremembering, but I think my win percentage against him is kind of like maybe like somewhere between 20% and 30%, which
pretty high for
which is pretty good, you know, for how dominant he's been.
Yeah, mine's more like 2 or 3%, I think.
Yeah.
Were there any times where maybe some of these tactics or chirping backfired against an opponent?
I remember back in UCLA days, that was even before that. I was just, you know, I was coming off the bench and I was just in the starting lineup and we played against Stanford and it was Dave Goss. And early first and second set, I probably stuffed him 5 balls, just in his face. And he was an All-American and, you know, each celebration for me was bigger and bigger. And then all of a sudden he woke up in the third set, and the third, fourth, and fifth set, he was unstoppable. He broke the NCAA record, 55 kills. And I was just like, hey, maybe that wasn't the smartest sleeping dog to wake up.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about this. So maybe take me through this. So you're preparing for a match, say later in your career, or someone like Stein. So you're kind of checking within yourself. How am I feeling? Where am I at? And then you're thinking about, okay, where's my partner at? How can I help them out? And then you're kind of sizing up the other side, like, you know, who's the victim over there? Is that the process?
I don't know if it's that. You know, right? You get a book on how to beat teams.
Yeah.
And sometimes how to beat teams is get a block and celebrate and just ride them. Sometimes it's to take a person totally out of the game. Right? So, I think that's the thing, is that, like, this is towards the more advanced stages, and a lot of times at the more advanced stages is it depends on the feel that you have. It depends on how much history you know on the other side. It's an art. It's not a science, I don't think.
Yeah. So I can imagine if you're not feeling like yourself, you're kind of focused on that and taking care of your own game first. That's the first step.
Yeah. I think that's a great. Good point. Right. You take care of the first things first, big things first.
So then you talked about it before, but wondering more, you know, especially in long tournaments. I know you played in Manhattan Beach. I think you and maybe Finoy played just a ton of matches in the deep sand and pretty hot weekend. Just wondering, like, in situations like that in our sport where it becomes an endurance sport, how you would kind of go into that Prius mode. What some things you would do to help yourselves get through that?
I think some of the same things that Phil does, right? Where you don't celebrate as much. You're not running around doing cartwheels as much. You can burn a lot of calories out there if you want, or you can keep it a little bit more focused. And I think, like, a lot of people give Phil a little bit of grief on that, but you know, when you're playing as many matches as they are every weekend, and not just one weekend, but the whole summer, you kind of got to go in that mode a little bit.
And what about in between matches? What are you doing to kind of recover and make sure you're ready for the grind?
You know what I didn't do enough of, and I look back on, I should have been jumping in the water after every match, you know, especially in California, especially when we got that nice cold water. I feel like I could have done a better job of that. Yeah, it's, you know, I look back and I just go, wow, I wish I could have made some, made some changes along the way.
Would you ever do things like early in the tournament, kind of alter the way you'd play, like maybe shoot around more or try to save yourself a little bit?
For sure. I think, you know, like it depends on where you are in your career, right? If you're just trying to grind out battles, then you got to play your A game every time. But if you, you know, there were years when I had first two rounds were pretty cake, right? And you're just working on your range, you're working on your cutty, your line shot, you're not hitting as much, you're playing efficient, and you also know you got to stay in the winner's bracket. So I think another thing I did was I split block way more than, probably max efficiency. I guess I would kind of say, like in poker, the poker world, there's a certain play that's best on one specific hand. But if you look at it as a macro tournament, sometimes you're not making the most efficient play on each play because you're thinking about the big picture.
Mm. And John, have you, I know I don't enjoy hitting lines quite as much as I did when I first started playing. John, is there anything that's changed as far as your approach to the game in this regard? You're pretty Prius-esque.
Yeah, for sure. I think I used to, I'd want to bounce some balls and I'd run and shag it. And in between plays, I'd run everywhere. Now I kind of linger around and maybe hit a couple of balls in warmups. And it's way different. I feel like it's a lot more of a kind of get your mind right than your body will be ready once the match starts.
Hey, you guys got me curious now. What? I know you guys are both good at getting yourself ready, you've developed into being really good teammates and getting your partners ready. Have you guys gotten to the point where you're pressing people's buttons and stuff?
Not me. I'll never be the great player. I feel like that's something I don't even consider. I mean, I treat everybody like they're the Phil, where I just ignore them. The only difference would be, I think when I played Ty Trambley, I compliment him a lot.
Yeah,
because he wants to get mad.
Right, so that's a little bit of gamesmanship.
Yeah, great shot, Ty, man, that was really good. Wow.
Yeah, I think I'm the same way. I don't know, I feel like I'm not there. I'm just a good player, not a great player.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I feel like I put all my thoughts into, it's hard enough for me to try to side out and serve, and so I'm just kind of focused on me. But I'd love to be able to get people rattled and get some points that way too. That's why we're talking to you,
Kevin.
And then I think back on like Karch, right? He didn't do anything outwardly gnarly. He would celebrate, right? He was super aggressive. I think the thing about him was that you knew you were for a battle every single time you played against him. And that was pretty intimidating, right? Because you knew you had to be ready. And there was a consistency. And so maybe that's where you guys are. You guys are on the Karch track of consistency.
Oh, yeah. We'll take that. We're just like Karch.
And Kevin, you mentioned with some of the kids that you teach at the youth age, maybe a lot of clubs are working on the fundamentals with ball control and stuff like that. But what are you teaching them, I guess, on the mental side that maybe some other clubs are overlooking?
Some of these things, right? And I think that you guys are onto it. I saw a John Mayer practice, and I think you guys are totally in that realm. I like indoor. We have techniques to slow the momentum down, you know, and you got to practice them. And it sounds crazy, but an extra 10 seconds out there, an extra 15 seconds, all of a sudden, I don't have to burn a timeout, and it serves the purpose. I think the rule of thumb. When you got the momentum, you want to play as many plays in that time as possible. When you don't have the momentum, you want to slow things down until you get the momentum back.
Cool. And where did you learn some of these tactics? Is it something that you see going away in today's game? Or is it something that is just as important now as always?
I think you guys are more subtle about things now, right? I feel like there's more accountability. It's social media. There's instant replays. There's people watching, I think back in I played in the wild, wild west. And so, at Punahou, we learned to wipe the floors, you know, make sure that floor was super dry, especially when we were giving up points. At UCLA, I learned that, the refs are human and they're going to go on body language, and you got to help them make some close calls, especially. So touches and lines, you got to, you got to emote the body language that you would emote for the call that you want. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's, I think it's most winning programs, I feel like they do similar things.
And I know you mentioned being a poker player, and I think there was a time where you were a lot more avid in it. Was that kind of a part of your, maybe as you became a veteran, did you get into poker at the same time? Was that kind of part of this gamesmanship? I think those two came hand in hand.
I think at the highest level of beach volleyball, it's you know, like when I think about, I think Johnny's there. I know you're there. I didn't mean that as a dismissive thing, Johnny. I know that you're both there. I would put Haydn near the top of the list. I wrote some notes down, and I think like level one of beach volleyball, it's trying to control the ball. And then level two is you start communicating and you're working with your partner a little bit more. Level three, you're bringing in vision. And I feel like for a lot of players, it takes forever. They might not even get to level three. You know, a lot of players are just looking at the ball. And then at level four, it's like, I have my vision, you see me. And all of a sudden it's a poker game, right? Are you going to break? Are you going to stay? What did you do last time? What did you do the last time I played you in this situation? And I feel like that's where, for me, it becomes really fun to play beach volleyball.
Mm. So you would have, you kind of go through like prior hands or prior matches to remember kind of some of their strategies going into.
Yeah,
matches.
And then you build these macro strategies, right? Like I remember Dax Holdren was the first guy who would ever go to the line early on defense. Right. And no one does that. I don't know if anyone does that much now anymore. But like that was baffling for me because it changed all my vision patterns, because you're used to seeing someone somewhere in the angle. You're used to seeing them lean or fake it was really a tough adjustment for me. And for a lot of players, I don't even think they would even notice it. Right. Because they were watching the ball. But I had to kind of break it down. And all of a sudden, my way to beat Dax was all the fakes, everything else, I would just make him move as far as I could on every play, because he was in Prius mode and I wanted to make sure that I made him, you know, in long distance mode. So if he was in the line early, I'd hit a cutty far away. Even if he was breaking, that's okay, because he had to do a lot of work.
Yeah, I feel like that part of the game, they're thinking this, I'm thinking that, the chess match is where it's fun too, because I feel like I played John Mayer so many times at practice, and then I play him in tournaments too, and we both know each other's game, and that's where it's kind of exciting, because I feel like you play a team that for the first time you're kind of just reacting a lot, where John, it's like, right, I know he thinks I want to do this every single time, so I gotta throw this in a little bit.
Billy wants the shoot line.
Right.
But I'm
right.
Sitting on it.
He still does
like
it.
For example, I play against Phil, and I would script out my first four side outs of the match. I would come in and go big jump, line shot. And the reason why is they never block angle for the whole first set, almost the first half of the set for sure. Mm. They're a team, and maybe they've changed since, but like, I just knew how I would play against certain teams, you know, that he's an old school player. He wants to seal line, make you go really high. Nick wants to sit in the angle, and that's kind of, you know, I had, and every team I had a little bit of a different book on them, on their tendencies.
Why do you think you had – is that part of the reason you had success against Phil? I mean, obviously siding out against him is challenging. But I think you also blocked Todd pretty well.
Yeah. What was my secret on Todd? I would start in the middle. I'd give him line. I'd always give him a little sliver of line and then jump back to it, because he was the best at feeling you leaving the line. So if I flipped it on him and started a little bit in the middle of the court, it was much tougher for him to read, right? It was a different visual pattern.
Nice. And while we're on the subject, do you have any stories of roofing John Mayer and getting in his head?
Johnny Mayer is, I got him early in his career, right?
Oh, yeah.
I'd get him
got me
early
a lot.
In his career. Got me a lot. I would do the little baby V where, you know, you stand in the line and then your seam hand gets real active, which I feel like is a place where a lot of people get blocks.
It looked like angle was open every time.
And I didn't. I was good against players who weren't going OT. The guys who killed me were Jake Gibb, right? Because there's no, it's not poker. It's like war, and he's got all the aces, and he's just going right over the top.
Nice.
Yeah, but Johnny got vision, and all of a sudden he owned me. I don't think I scored any points against him after that.
Right.
I don't remember that. So if you were, you know, you got to play in a couple different eras in the even the bigger court with some big personalities, and you saw a lot of changes throughout the years. But if you were to rank maybe in the pantheon of gamesmanship, like who's the top three all time who are able to really kind of change the match, you know, outside of their play?
I'd say Karch, just because of his gnarliness and who he was. And it wasn't gamesmanship, but it was like, you think about it, it's like the intimidation factor. And he had that. You go into a match, you knew you were in for a grinded out battle. I think Stein was the next guy. He was a guy who could pump you up, make you feel unstoppable. He could also get in the other team's brain. Sometimes it was worth 3, 4, 5 points. And also he was great at, you know, they talked about Shaq being like the big canopy tree for some of his teams, where he took all the heat and all the pressure because everyone was looking at him and everyone else could kind of hide in the canopy and play their game. I feel like sometimes with Stein it was the same thing. After that, I don't know, man. Throw some other ideas out at me.
Big drop off, huh? I think you're number three then.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I wasn't. I was too much in my own brain, you know. Like you got to be.
What about like Hav?
Hav was like aggressive. You always knew he was going to be aggressive. I think MD was the guy who was a little bit more. He'd play possum sometimes. He was the opposite of Karch, right? He would just like, he'd barely jump. He'd barely move around the court, but like he had these bursts and he would save. I remember talking to him at one point in time. He's like, I'm not going to run for that line shot. I'm going to wait for that line shot because I know at, 14, 13, you're going to hit line and I'm going to run to it and I'm going to save that point for the end. Right. So it's kind of like some different thinking. I think he was underestimated, and he was also a great team player.
Yeah.
I feel like
Yeah, all those. I feel like all three of those are great teammates, too.
Yeah. If I have one regret, I think I would have gone back and I would have been a better teammate. I feel like I didn't learn that empathy and I didn't learn that side. I was such a perfectionist, and I just had this too high a bar. And if I'd done it again, I think I would. That's would have been my biggest regret, my biggest change, is being a better partner.
Yeah, that's huge. I think when Todd was on here, he had the same thing. And I feel like he was maybe more of an obvious choice for him about being hard on his partners. Speaking of the Stein thing, I think I remember at the end of his career, he was coaching you, John, you and Brad a little bit.
Yep.
And then he was also kind of came back and started playing. And I remember a match where he was serving Brad underhand deep and putting him, just wrecking him.
Yeah, and it worked. I still have nightmares about that match. Yeah.
So it was the comeback trail, and he had no shoulder, and he beat you guys?
Him and Mark Williams. No, he could swing fine. He just wanted to serve, like, this high, deep middle ball and move Brad, like, all the way back to the end line.
I feel like that's, like, the least utilized serve. Like, I if I was to go back and coach college women, I think that, like, all my blockers for sure would serve that ball because it's so hard to pass. It's so hard to set. It takes you out of your rhythm, and it's cumulative, right? So I feel like that people aren't doing that enough.
That was part one with Kevin Wong. Join us next week for part two. Hi, everyone. So this is where, in a normal successful podcast, you might hear a sponsor ad, something we've been missing at Coach Your Brains Out. So we're asking for some listener help instead. If you enjoy the show and are able to support it, we'd love to have you head over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/coachyourbrainsout. Anything you can contribute, even a dollar an episode, $4 a month would really help cover our hosting costs and John Mayer's speaking fee and help us continue doing the show. That's patreon.com/coachyourbrainsout. Thank you. We appreciate the support. Now here's today's episode.
Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
So we talked about Karch, and we know you played with him at the end of his career, his final season. So what were some of the things you learned from that partnership?
Man, my career would have been so different if I had played with him at the beginning of it instead of at the end. He was literally the guy who not only told me, but showed me, practice every day like it's the gold medal match. And then when you're in the gold medal match, it's like practice. It's the craziest thing. We would play at Emerald Bay 2 days a week, and we'd do the craziest workout even before practice. And so maybe about 45 minutes of like medi ball and sprints and jumps. And then we'd have like a 15-minute, snack break and relax. And then when we went into pepper the first day, this freaked me out because – You know, everyone else, you throw the ball back and forth. You kind of start off 50% pepper and you work your way into it. I tossed him the first ball and he about took my head off. He just crushed it. And I looked at him like I thought he was joking or he made a mistake or something. But that, like, that's happened every time. He was 100% out of the gates. And, there's a reason why he was such a special person, such a special athlete. He was amazing.
And then what about in, say, tournament play? What are some things that stood out to you?
He didn't coach at all. Not once did we talk X's and O's. He just kind of take care of his play. He would – every mistake that our team would make, he would blame on himself. So much so that I would at the beginning, it took me some time to get used to because it really wasn't reality. But I think that was the whole thing, right? Is it's like, what's best for the team? Let's, move on after each play, give 100%, be a good teammate. He was pretty crazy.
Yeah, I remember hearing he wasn't a big scout guy. Like, he didn't want to know who's playing next. He just wanted to know what time. And then maybe leaves it up to you to kind of give him that information and check the board. Is that true?
Yeah, it was strange. Like, at the beginning of the matches, you always go to your partner and go like, hey, let's start off on this person and then do this and blah, blah, blah. That, I mean, I would say it, but he would never initiate it. And it really wasn't the most important thing to him, but he would also follow your game plan too. So it was really strange because you expect this alpha leader guy to take it, and try to run with all the planning, and he couldn't care less about that part of the game.
Are there any other things he did in preparation that stood out to you that kind of set him apart from other partners?
He was routine, right? He had an amazing routine. So like Billy said, he wanted to know exactly what time the match was, and then he'd start his clock and he'd start his pre-routine, I don't know what it was, like 17 minutes before or 22 minutes and 30 seconds before, but it was clockwork. And I think that's really important too, right? You take all the guesswork out, you make sure whether it's the first match or the last match, you're doing the same thing and paying attention to detail.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to be crushing Ryan and Pepper tomorrow.
It's going to be short rallies.
Kevin, can you tell us the story of you and Casey Jennings losing in the qualifier in The Hague in 2010?
Yeah, that was.
I mean, it sounds like a bad story when I set it up there, but
no, yeah, it was the roller coaster, right? Is that we were playing pretty well, and when you go internationally and you play these single eliminations, it's so much pressure, and it's so much based on the draw and how they're playing, and it's like so much out of your control. And that weekend, we won because we let go, and we lost the match to a really inspired Brazilian team to get into the tournament, and You know, so you go through your mourning process. You are super bummed. You're angry. You're like, what am I doing over here in Europe? I could be home in LA. I spent all this money. All the different thoughts that go through your head. And then you go, hey, let's go to the meeting just in case someone doesn't show up. And so how it works is that if teams sign up and then they don't show up, then they'll do a drawing and you become the lucky loser and you can get back in the tournament. Whoever, all the names that go in the hat are all the teams that lost the last match to get in. So I think it was like 8 teams maybe, and 2 teams didn't show up. And the first draw goes to like France or something like that. And then the last and final draw, Casey Jennings' best buddy is Pedro. He runs up and he goes, I'm going to draw this. And like magic, he opens out of the bucket. He opens it up and he just like starts sprinting and jumping and dancing. And he hasn't even given the paper to anyone yet. So he's got to give the paper and they're like, well, Jennings and Wong. So we get in and it was the craziest tournament ever. It was sideways rain, so like the wind was probably 30-40 miles an hour the whole tournament. It was probably 40 to 50 degrees, and everyone there was complaining. The balls were heavy, there's no one in the stands, and you think about it, Casey and I were playing with the house's money. We were so excited just to be in the tournament, and so you know, we were laughing in the rain, we were just it was like kids playing out there. And the final match, you see, it's like who is Benjamin, and he's like throwing tantrums, and he's like, you know, swearing, and he's pissed, and all this negative energy. And whether we were winning or losing, we just were so in the moment, letting it go and just letting it flow. And it was a pretty special weekend.
Awesome. You guys ended up winning the tournament after that. That's crazy.
Yeah, undefeated, 6-0 or 7-0, beat some really good teams. Yeah, it was. Biggest check of the year. The sad thing is I think I only got half of it because I didn't play in enough to get bonus pool. So I think I left like $10,000 on the table there.
I thought you were going to say you gave half to Pedro.
I probably should have, right? Or at least 20%.
So that moment where like it's adverse conditions, it's windy, it's maybe not the most fun volleyball, it's closer to Volus or whatever, and you guys just kind of let it go and just have fun. Were you able to take that mindset with you to like future events when you for had sure. kind of adverse conditions?
For sure. You know, like when you get to mastery in our sport, it becomes much less about like, how do we win this match? And it becomes much more about how do I play to the best of my abilities? Right. And I think that that's where you start taking all the nerves away. And that's where you start really becoming process oriented, effort oriented, rather than results oriented.
So we mentioned, you know, this tournament was with Casey Jennings, who I think before you guys partnered up, you guys were, I don't know about enemies, but you guys would battle it out on the court for sure. Maybe enemies is right. I think you guys are very different personalities. So I'm wondering, like, yeah, how did you make that adjustment playing with someone who you hadn't always seen eye to eye with?
You know, like I had a lot of experience with that because at UCLA, we battled every day. And so for example, Eric Sullivan, who was in my same class in Olympic libero, when he's coaching now at Texas, he was the guy where if he was on the other side of the court, you hated him. And then all of a sudden you're on the same team and you're like, this guy's the best guy ever. Right. He had like, let's go to battle. And I think that you learn that along the ways. And I always did best with partners who had very different personalities than me. Stein's the same. Casey's the same. Casey Patterson the same. I feel like that's the yin and the yang is a real thing.
So you appreciated it.
Yeah. You know, that's the other, it makes it tougher, right? When you're traveling, it makes it tougher when you are spending all the time and over the couple of years, because those same things start bugging you more and more. But mm-hmm. You know, if you have perspective, if like that's kind of what it goes into. If I had the perspective to look back and appreciate the differences that my partner brought to the table, then I think I would have been a better partner.
Taking notes here. So next one, the world has caught up and is, you know, definitely past the U.S. in beach volleyball, at least in the depth and in a lot of senses. What do you think we need to be doing to be stronger and more competitive internationally?
There's a dearth of blockers. I think that that's the biggest thing, right? Is that like the top teams are have the top blockers a lot of times, and obviously the best defenders are with those blockers. But I think the more big blockers we have, the deeper the talent pool and the more challenging the tournaments are. And we have guys, you know, we had an AVP Next tournament 2 months ago, and there's a 6'9" guy who came up from Long Beach City College, and he has skills, and he's 21 years old, 22 years old. I think they just, you know, any other country, that guy would get a check for $25,000 a year, and he'd have all his coaching, all his training, all his travel paid for. And I think that that's something we got to look at, because we need more blockers.
Yes, we do.
And what about from anything from like a skill standpoint jump out at you?
I think the different balls are probably the biggest thing that I would notice, right? It's tough. And you look at these finishes, one or two plays makes all the difference in a set or a loss. And those balls track and the flight and the way they handle so different. And I think that that's kind of a little bit of a disadvantage. Mm. What do you guys think? I don't know. I'm allowed to ask questions, right?
Yeah, you are. But then you make us think. I think there's a lot. I mean, I think some of it is when I see these players, they're 23 and 24, and their ball control is at just a really high level because they've been playing the game for a long time at a high level, I think both indoors and on the beach. So they have that, and there's obviously a physical aspect as well. So you got just the combination of youth, experience, and really good athletes, and I think our players don't get that experience on the beach until later, and maybe we lose some of that physicality, but hopefully with college beach that's going to be changing on the women's side. For the men's side, I think we're gonna have to get lucky.
Yeah, you got to find another Phil, right? That's the challenge,
and that's tough.
So I think that it starts there. I really do, because there's such a deep talent pool in the U.S. and we've just kind of let the market play out. Whereas other countries, they've got like their pool of 10 guys in the whole country, and they invest a ton of money, a ton of time, a ton of expertise in them. And I don't see the same thing. And maybe the new Hildebrand program will be that. We can't just let things play out anymore. I think we got to force the issue more and invest in it a little bit more, and start picking people more. I think that that's the toughest political job, is if USA Volleyball says we're picking you, there's going to be 19 other people saying, why not me?
Yeah, definitely a hard spot. And I think the better the domestic tour is, the stronger it is, the more you can draw a Phil from Florida or a Jake from Utah to come chase that dream. So,
you know. For sure.
That's a big piece. So there's a lot of factors.
Yeah, and that's one of the strengths of the U.S., right? The AVP and how well it's going. Like, I've talked to Ari Graça from Brazil. They're spending like $10 million a year back in the day to subsidize their domestic tour. China mm-hmm. was spending nearly $10 million to run their three or four FIVB events. And that's something that USA Volleyball doesn't have to do, because it's already kind of being done.
Yep.
Then Kevin, you shared with us a few things, maybe regrets or things you might change as far as being a better partner. Is there anything else as far as just even how you would structure a practice, or anything else we can steal from you for the final couple of years of our careers?
This is totally random. Might not even be answering your question, but like one of the cool things about my job is I get to go to the Olympics and I get to talk to every team 10 minutes before the biggest match of their lives. And you start hearing what the teams say that end up winning. And there's like full patterns going on. And the teams that end up winning can answer this one question. They can answer to themselves why we should win this match. The teams that inevitably lose are the teams that say, hey, there's no pressure on us. Hey, we're the underdog. We're not supposed to win this match. we're going to just give our best effort. Those teams always lose because, you know, you're on the biggest stage and you're lying to yourself. There is lots of pressure. And, that's one of the things I've learned is you got to answer that. You got to answer that question. And it kind of translates to every match, every AVP tournament is, why should Billy Allen be winning these tournaments?
And what sort of why would you hear?
You have to have multiple whys, but the universal why is I've worked harder than anyone else here. Right? Kerry, famous quote right before, like, it was like Beijing, super rainy. She says something to the effects. Every practice that we went to when it was raining, we saw other people canceling, and we did. We're ready for this. We're going to win. Right? Mm-hmm. So, like, it's the work ethic. And then beyond that, it has to be like, so if I'm Billy Allen, I'm going to say, I'm going to win this because I have better vision, I have better skills, and I have better conditioning than anyone else in the world. And if you don't believe that, Billy, then you're not going to win all those.
Mm-hmm. I like that. That was a good nugget in there, man.
I'm writing
30 minutes in. I got a nugget.
I'm writing that one down in bold.
There's been a lot of them, but I think that was the best one. All right. So now we have a couple listener questions. The first one is from who we've mentioned a couple times, from Stein Metzger.
Shut up.
Yep, your former partner and the head coach at UCLA. It's a would you rather question. Number one is, would you rather get whipped by an iguana's tail or have a dead fish stashed in your hotel room and not be able to find it? I'm guessing there's more to this than we recognize.
Oh, that's so good. The reason he's asking that is I've had both of those things. He got an iguana. We were roommates. Yeah, he got an iguana at UCLA, and we had a cage, but it was not in the cage. So it was just patrolling our house nonstop. I don't think we fed it. I'm amazed it lived, and it was the most nasty, demeanor iguana. And yeah, it was hissing. It was whipping tails. It was pretty funny that we got through that. And then Espino, which is where the tournament was just last weekend. Someone played a trick on me and Sean Scott, and they hit a dead fish in our vent, and it just kept on getting worse and worse. I think the fish was a little bit more gnarly, personally. That's my answer.
That does seem. That's what I went with. That's what I was going to go.
Yeah.
You and Stein have had a long and maybe at times up and down relationship, but been through a lot together, huh?
Yeah. You know, he's, like I said, we were so different in personalities. Mm-hmm. And his ability to cope with anything, even my rough edges, was pretty special. I wasn't quite as hardy in terms of, like, you know, like if we had disagreements and stuff. And so, in retrospect, I should have said, hey, can we talk about this, you know, and process it as a team instead of, I just kind of held on to things and I internalized it. And that's not good. And I think that's the side of partnerships that sometimes people overlook is it's like a marriage out there because you're doing business together. You are spending a ton of time together. You have hopes and dreams together. There should be a little bit more, partnership counseling, I think, along the ways. Have you ever heard of anyone having counseling?
Well, there's sports psychologists now that I think that's part of their job. I think it's definitely underrated and probably overlooked a lot.
Do you get to work with anyone on a regular basis?
Yeah. USA Volleyball now lets us see Peter Haberl, who works with USOC.
I liked him. I got to work with him a bunch too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's really good and had some other people through the years. I really value that. But I don't know if everyone does. And I think, like you're saying, it's a really important piece.
John, do you leave those sessions crying too? Or is it just me?
I walk in crying.
Yeah. Hey, Kevin, you lived at 927 Flower in Venice.
Yeah.
The volleyball house with kind of maybe half the tour that at one time or another. Any good Baxter stories or any Reeve or Flower Avenue stories?
I lived with Baxter, Paul Baxter, for probably 10 years, and we'd see him like once a month come out of the room in the back. He's also seems like he's gotten much more personable over the end of his career. Super hard worker, you know, and probably one of the more underrated players in the history of Beach. I feel like just never really got dialed in with one of the great partners that he probably deserved. And then the other great memory I had is how we thought we were so good at Halo, until the East Coast boys came in, and that was like Adam Roberts and Phil and Nick, and they just plastered us. And I'll tell you, like, Phil's hand-eye coordination and his timing and his vision and eye work, he's like the unicorn, man, because he was amazing at that, at Halo too.
Phil, is he bad at anything? Gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, Phil.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we got one more question, and this one is from Scott Wong, the head coach. He says, Kevin's been the best example to me of positive change, despite how tough change may be. An example would be how he has become, in his color commentary, he's become one of the best in the world. So the question is, what's your process of growth when change is hard?
My NBC producer said it best. First conversation we had, he said, Pierre Moussa, he said, we can either spend the first 10 minutes of every session talking about how great you are and smoothing your ego over and making you feel good about yourself, and we waste those 10 minutes, or we can get in and I can bring the criticism and I can bring the needs for change. And if you have the kind of toughness and the kind of open mindset to deal with that, we can do a lot better and get to a higher level. And I think that that's the biggest part, right? Is people are really afraid of criticism. They protect themselves, they protect their ego. And if you can check your ego, and if you can buy into the growth mindset, I think that you can do anything. He's right. I was so shy. I wasn't very outspoken, but, you know, I had this opportunity and I was willing to check my ego and turn it into something.
Nugget number two.
Kevin, what brought you in that direction? If you were maybe shy at the time, like, what led you to want to pursue that?
I think it was the opportunity more than anything. Karch, it was luck, right? A lot of life is luck, right? Being in the right place at the right time. How Johnny Merritt got the LMU job, kind of similar situation.
Pretty much.
So Karch went from the Beach commentary to coaching women's. And so this was 2 years after we played. And he said, hey, they're going to do an open tryout. Is this something you'd be interested in? And my first reaction was probably to be like, no, this isn't my skill set. But when you have something like that, an opportunity, you that's something that you can't say no to. And so for the next 2-3 months, I like immersed myself in it. I think that's the other thing. You got to immerse. You got to be 100%. You know, I've got 12, 13, 14 year old girls in our beach club. And you can tell there's one girl who goes home and her mom says she watches like 4 hours of YouTube video on Brazilian defenders. You can tell when people immerse yourselves. And I did the same thing in broadcasting. I watched a ton. I got some reps at the high school broadcast in Hawaii. I got to sit in the truck. I got to talk to Karch. I talked to Chris McLaughlin, who's one of my mentors and does the Hawaii broadcast. And I committed myself to at least the effort of it. And, somehow came through.
I feel like it's easy, not easy, but I feel like a lot of people say like, yeah, I want feedback. I want to get better. Tell me the truth. But I think the reality is that stuff's hard to hear. And then it's hard to actually then look at it honestly and make those changes. Can you take us through that process a little bit? And are you still able to take criticism?
I think everyone's reaction, right? Your first impulse reaction is always going to be self-defense.
Yeah.
And I think that you have to train yourself that maybe that's your first reaction, but then when you process, what's your true reaction? And I think it's like, I've got this flinch attitude, and then it's like an openness, and it's like, and sometimes it's like, you got to have the confidence to then take the walls down and be sensitive to people. And I wouldn't say you let everyone in, right? Mm. You got to pick your people that are your mentors and the people that you trust, because there's a lot of nonsense out there too.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So you surround yourself with good people, right? Like you guys do that. So you surround yourself with good people. You bounce ideas off. You don't play defense. I don't try to copy other people. I think that's the other thing. You got to be authentically you. And maybe it's your best you, but like these conversations I have with Marlo on the air, those are the conversations that are interesting to me. You know, those are things that I talk to you guys about on a regular basis. And I kind of think of, I never lower the bar and talk down to the audience. I always just kind of try to share what's going through my brain.
Well, thank you for sharing with us for the last 45 minutes.
Thanks, you guys. I really appreciate it. I'm gonna start my own webcast so I can ask you guys all the questions, because I truly feel like you guys are two of the better brains in this sport, and I learn from you guys on a regular basis.
Oh, thanks, Kevin. Nice of you to say. Well, I learned a lot here. There's more than I said two nuggets. There's a lot of good nuggets. So I appreciate you sharing all of it. And I think for anybody who's looking to pursue the game at a high level, they should definitely listen to your insights. And then I think for sure, like hearing about your growth as a commentator, gosh, that's an awesome takeaway for me to hear. So thanks for spending the time and doing this. This is great.
Appreciate it. Keep up the good work, you guys, and I'll see you guys in San Fran.
All right, yeah. There. Thanks, Kevin.
See you in the finals.
All right, you guys. Sounds good. Hold on.